This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So you're probably familiar with at least some of the specifics. The Democratic candidate for president wins Virginia by 3 full percentage points. The Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate wins Virginia by almost 5 points. But it's also worth noting that Virginia elected more than twice as many Republicans as Democrats to the U.S. House. Plus, we still have a Republican governor and Republicans in control of both houses of Virginia's General Assembly. So if you're reading the tea leaves about what comes next in Old Dominion politics, what do you see? Professional politics watchers Bob Roberts from JMU, Bob Gibson from Sorensen, and White House correspondent Anita Kumar have agreed to share their view. If you've got one to contribute, our phone lines will be open at 888-967-2825, 888-WMRA-TALK, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Our call-in number is 888-967-2825. Easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. So here's a quick look at the before and after. Before election 2012, Virginians had two Democrats representing them in the U.S. Senate, and out of 11 U.S. House of Representative districts, three belong to Democrats, eight to Republicans. Now that the election is over, Virginia has eight Republican congressmen, three Democratic congressmen, and two Democratic senators. So what's changed? Anything in your view? Anything about what you believe Virginia voters intended when they went to the polls? Anything about what you'd like to see happen next in Virginia politics? No matter who won their respective races, 888-967-2825 to toss your voice into the conversation. And while we wait for your call, our expert panel is here to help. Speaking with us by phone, McClatchy Newspaper's White House correspondent Anita Kumar. Plus, from a studio in Charlottesville, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson. And here in the Insight Studio in Harrisonburg, James Madison University's political scientist, Bob Roberts. Welcome all.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Hey, Bob Gibson, you first. What did Virginia voters say in this most recent election?
Well, they said they were willing to stand in line for 2 hours or more or longer to vote for Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, more of them for Barack Obama. They said they were willing to stand in line for more than 2 hours to vote for their incumbents for Congress, most of them, because 10 of those 11 House seats were decided by landslide margins. Only the Norfolk, Virginia Beach 2nd District was less than a landslide, but still a very significant margin. They said that Tim Kaine was their favorite former governor running for the U.S. Senate by 52-47 over George Allen.
Well, I think more important than the numbers is that the Democrats showed in two successive presidential elections they had the ability to turn out the vote, which Republicans clearly did not think they could do this time. They thought the Obama people would fall behind. They couldn't get out their vote. And they got it out in about the same numbers they got it out before, which was remarkable, particularly since the economy of the nation was so bad and Virginia's economy is doing all right. But it still was a remarkable achievement to carry this state when Romney thought he had the state in the bag. And I think
so
they were shocked.
It was not the angry electorate of 2010.
That's right.
Anita Kumar there in Washington, now that you're out of the state capital of Richmond, have you heard anything from the Obama White House about their attitude towards Virginia's vote? Were they surprised that they got as big a win in Virginia as they did?
Well, I think Virginia was one of the ones that was showing sort of the closest that maybe Florida right before the election. But they really attribute the win, part of the win anyway, to the fact that they've basically been now in Virginia for 5 or 6 years. So when President, then Senator Obama, came into the state 5 years ago, they set up offices, they had staff, they had volunteers. Those people, a lot of those folks stayed or, they brought other people in. So they've basically been working to get out the vote, to encourage people, recruit volunteers, knock on doors for 5 years, his whole term. I think they really attribute that to the win. Governor Romney came in, Republican Party did way, way more outreach than they had in 08. I mean, just leaps and bounds more. But it still probably couldn't compare to what the president has had over these many years.
It was interesting how badly they did in rural areas. In other words, they didn't increase their numbers in rural areas of the state, and they spent a lot of time. And that's surprising. I mean, they should have been able to get more of the vote out, particularly the white male vote out in the rural areas, and they just didn't do it.
Yeah, the Republican Party of Virginia says this time, probably for the first time in years, if ever, that they actually went to every part of the state. I mean, even in very blue areas, Charlottesville, Arlington, they were knocking on doors and they were calling people, and they really did have a massive effort this year. But
yeah.
I think that, you know, starting something that year is in 1 year is very different than being here for 5 years.
So to you who are listening, if you've got your pad ready and your pen and pencil out, I've got a bunch of numbers to throw at you. If you don't have them ready, that's okay. You'll just get a general impression. Bob Roberts and I, before we turn the microphones on, have been taking a look at recent turnouts. And I want to go back as much as 7 years, because it was in 2005 that Virginia last elected a Democrat for governor, the guy who a few days ago won his seat in the U.S. Senate. And in 2005, 45% of the Virginia electorate turned out for that gubernatorial election. In the next year, which was a congressional off-year election, 2006, 52.7% of the Virginia electorate turned out. In 2007, where the only thing that was sort of major statewide was the state legislature, the state Senate, and the House of Delegates, mm-hmm. what's commonly referred to as the General Assembly. In 2007, just barely 30% of Virginia voters turned out. And then the next year, in 2008, there was almost 75%, 74.5%.
Right.
The biggest turnout probably in Virginia history
right.
in a presidential election. And if you really want it, to you who are listening, we also have numbers for 2009 and 2010. but that might be enough for now. The State Board of Elections has not yet put up its calculation for voter turnout in this presidential year. But you were doing some math there,
right,
Bob.
It's about 71% of all registered voters, which I don't like, because a lot of those are basically voters who are not participating.
Yeah, Virginia has this thing called active voters. But to compare year to year,
right,
when they
71%.
Put up the numbers, you got to say
it's about 71%.
71% for this presidential election versus 74.5%
right.
4 years ago for the last presidential election. So turnout was lower.
Yeah.
Usually when turnout is lower, Republicans do better.
Yeah, but the Democratic turnout was pretty good. And the Republicans fell short of their goals and expectations, which is surprising. I had predicted wrongly that Romney would win Virginia. I predicted Obama would win the Electoral College. But I was surprised at the amount of time and money they spent in Virginia. And the Romney people spent fortunes. And the super PACs spent fortunes. They couldn't increase substantially their turnout base, which to me in the long term does not bode well for the Republican Party in the state. Because like the National Republican Party, they're going to have to make inroads into Hispanic voters, other women voters, or they will not have a bright future in presidential races in this state. I'm not saying they can't win a governorship because turnout is much lower, but to win presidential elections, they're going to have to broaden their base or probably experience the same fate.
So to you who are listening, if you did vote in the recent election, if you were part of the 71% of registered voters who did, what were things like at the polls for you? Any idea about whether it was the way it should be, or did you see some need for improvement? 888-WMRA-TALK, how to reach us by phone. Do you see any implications for what's coming up next in Virginia politics based on who did turn out and who they voted for? For example, although this is stretching our memories back a bit, earlier this year, there was a lot of activism in the Republican base over what was going on in state government in the General Assembly. Remember all of those bills that were aimed at pleasing social conservatives. Perhaps the most controversial was the one about abortion and the so-called I forget the term, but it was an
ultrasound.
Invasive ultrasound. Yes. The transvaginal. The airline. Thank you, Anita. That became the famous airline on comedy shows, transvaginal ultrasound. Sorry. And it was later changed. But to you listening, do you have any sense that the Republicans overplayed their hand towards their base and that had any effect all those months later here in November during the election? Or do you think that just didn't make any difference at all? And we have another General Assembly session, state legislature controlled by Republicans coming back in session in January of 2013. Amazing how close that is. Not far off at all. You have any sense of what you think they're going to concentrate on this time or what you'd like them to concentrate on? 888-967-2825. We almost had a call that we were ready to take there, and we lost it. So if the caller wants to call us back, that would be fine. 888-WMRA-TALK, the easy way to remember the number. And here on Facebook, we already have some comments. This one from Ron, who says, one simple word, gerrymandering. The only reason the House GOP hangs on is the diluting of progressive voters, where state governments are controlled by the GOP. It's pretty telling that the races not influenced by gerrymandering, Senate and President, are solidly Democratic territory. Unfortunately, too many progressive voters stayed home in the election of 2010, a census year, a fatal mistake.
The commenter...
Ron.
Ron is correct. Gerrymandering preserved the seats of Democrats and Republicans alike in Virginia.
And across the nation.
And those House seats are not competitive any longer. And that's why when Republicans say we have a mandate for their policies, it's a somewhat dubious mandate. When you factor in gerrymander explains why they have a 35-seat majority in the House of Representatives.
Let's be clear that here in Virginia and elsewhere, the system favors the incumbent no matter who, whether they're Republican or Democrat. Republicans and Democrats, even Democrats who are now in the minority in the Senate, in the Virginia Senate, but were in the majority and are barely in the minority now, they went along. They've gone along with some of these things these last couple sessions. Because it also protected their three Democratic House members.
And, well, I agree.
It's probably worth noting, in response to Ron's comment, that there are still states in the union where Democrats control the legislature and the office of governor in their state. And most of those states are pretty good at gerrymandering to keep the Democrats in their state.
Yeah,
in
but if you really look at those Democratic states, that they are so Democratic right now, most of them.
They don't need gerrymandering.
Probably don't need gerrymandering.
I think they do it anyway.
They do it anyhow, but they're not going to. But it is interesting from the battle over the fiscal cliff that the Republican argument they have this overwhelming public mandate. It's not as strong as a mandate that a president has who wins enough electoral votes.
And there's another way of looking at it, because the total number of votes for Congress was higher for Democrats than it was for Republicans in the House of Representatives, even though the Republicans, through gerrymandering, successfully maintained that large majority.
You've been listening to our analysis panel, Anita Kumar, Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts. We got another voice to add. This is Jim in Edinburgh who's called in. Jim, your question or comment, please.
Hi. It seems kind of petty in comparison to your, you know, high, more important issues, but I have to have a round trip of 20 miles to vote. And I used to be able to just drive 4 miles. And I called up my supervisor, this part of the Shenandoah County, Steve Baker. Never get a reply back. And we used to have polling booths, like I said, much closer. They've closed both of them.
Did you still make that trip this past Election Day, Jim?
I did.
Jim, we're about to hit the break, and you're bringing up an issue that I think is important.
It's a good question.
So if you could hold on for us, we'll be back in about a minute. Can you wait a minute for us?
Sure enough.
We're going to continue here on Virginia Insight with Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy News Service, former newspaper reporter, now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Professor Bob Roberts, as well as perhaps your voice And we know Jim's going to stay with us, too. It all continues in a bit more than 60 seconds. Well, I feel a bit like I'm repeating myself here, but in case you just tuned in, Bob Roberts is a professor of politics and a professor of public policy at James Madison University. Bob Gibson reported on politics at the Charlottesville Daily Progress for some 30 years before taking his current post as executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Anita Kumar reported on Virginia politics for the Washington Post for many years, but this past summer switched to the McClatchy newspaper group, where she now serves as its White House correspondent. I'm Tom Graham, by the way. This is Virginia Insight. Jim on the line is telling us about changing his polling place in a way that just sounds really inconvenient, Bob Roberts.
Correct. I mean, having to drive 20 miles to vote is one way. Is it one way or both ways?
No, round trip.
Round trip. It's still silly. And it brings up a broader question nationally. Our voting system is in this country is absolutely broken. I mean, you look at state by state by state, what went on this time. Early voting problems on election day, people waiting 5 hours in line. That is absolutely not necessary. And in fact, it's designed to dissuade people from voting. And so I'm not sure when the country is going to wake up to the fact they don't have to vote like this in Virginia or anywhere else. But it seems like the local state and local officials are perfectly happy with the situation.
Jim, I'm curious, do you know people who in your area chose not to vote because they didn't want to drive that far?
I don't know. I can't tell you one way or the other on that.
Bob Gibson, is this an unusual distance in rural parts of Virginia, or are there some more rural counties where that's just the way it's become?
No, Jim's experience in Edinburgh is repeated by many rural voters across the state as they have to drive. I mean, in Fluvanna County, they have moved precincts so that people who live in Lake Monticello have to drive 10 miles to and 10 miles from. It's not uncommon, and it's up to the boards of supervisors, but they're looking to save money, whereas the way to fix this is to have more polling places, not fewer.
Jim, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. We're going next to Abington. This is Lynn. Lynn, you're on Virginia Insight with Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts, and Anita Kumar.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to comment and get your reaction. I think the legislature in Virginia at the last session brought out a lot of sentiment from women in particular about social issues intruding into individual freedoms. And I think they reacted to that by coming out and saying, stay away from this. And I think there was a tone of hypocrisy in some of the more strident Republican sentiment, because women are looking at their comments about government intrusion and saying, if you think the government is intruding in healthcare or business or regulation, then why are you coming into my bedroom and into my family? I also think, at least in the southwest part of the state, part of that was reflected in women becoming more verbal about those concerns, and in some cases, male spouses staying home and not voting.
I think Anita may disagree with this, but I think a major mistake the Republican Party of the state made early in the year was to push that conservative agenda. And I think that did play a role in how Virginia voted this recently. That did turn off a significant number of women in Northern Virginia and around the state. And the Republicans didn't recover from that. I think it was a major, major mistake.
I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think, though, I'm not sure how many people, remember. Maybe they remember, but attribute that to Mitt Romney. Of course, he wasn't involved. But it is the Republican Party, and they did do that. And so I do think, there was some of that. People remembered all those protests during the legislative session earlier this year, and it sort of left a bad taste in their mouth. I mean, the same thing happened in other states. And as you could see from the election results, President Obama, had a huge amount of, more. They had women support way more than Governor Romney. And so that is definitely one thing that the Republicans are going to have to look at going forward.
Bob Gibson, let me double check something with you. It's an assumption on my part. I'm not sure it's correct, but it is connected to Lynn's question. Republicans in Virginia's General Assembly, as well as across the nation, who oppose abortion, have tried to come up with a number of ways to limit access to abortion. At least that's what it looks like. They can't ban abortion because the Supreme Court says that it's legal. When they make these moves, it's certainly here in Virginia, it seems to me that what I hear most from them is saying, we are simply trying to protect women's health. If, in fact, it is true that the real agenda is to do what you can to limit abortion, shouldn't it also be noted that there are a significant percentage of female voters in Virginia and across the country who also oppose abortion?
Well, the perceived agenda is to limit abortion, whether it's the real agenda or not, and that becomes a campaign issue that leads to the gender gap. So there are plenty of women and there are plenty of men on both sides, but the Republican majority in the General Assembly has sort of taken the issue and pushed it as far as they can and then a little bit further in the eyes of some. I do know from Republican members of the House of Delegates that they have been told by their leadership to cool it on those social issues this coming session.
Lynn, I'm curious, in your experience, do you know any women who have a different view about abortion and reproductive rights, as it's often called, than you do?
Do I know women who have a different view?
Yeah. Do you know women, for example, who want abortion to be illegal or as difficult to obtain as possible?
I know some, but most of the people I know don't want government intrusion. For example, think of a daughter who's been subjected to rape. To have the government tell the parents that under no circumstances can their daughter have an abortion is too intrusive. And they want the freedom to at least consider that. And on the other side of the equation, you have the awakening back in January and February in Virginia. And then you have a national Republican platform that included anti-abortion under all circumstances, that included rape, included health of the mother, all those things. So you're taking decisions away from a family and away from women individually that seems totally inconsistent with other Republican values of individual freedom.
Bob Roberts, what Lynn says about the Republican platform nationwide is absolutely true, correct. But the Republican candidate made clear that he had a different view.
Right. He said he supported exceptions for rape and incest, but the dilemma here for the Republicans, like Bob Gibson was just mentioning, for the upcoming legislative session is that you're going to have a race for governor, and you have two candidates for governor on the Republican side who've taken fairly hardline positions on abortion. And the last thing in the world the Republican Party wants this time is for that legislative session to bring that abortion issue up again before a gubernatorial election in the fall. So it's not surprising that they're sending the word out that we don't want this to happen again because they saw what happened this time. But it's going to be very, very difficult for either Cuccinelli or Bowlings to run away from this issue. And I guarantee you that in the fall, the Democrats are going to make this a key issue in the gubernatorial race. They're going to throw everything they can on the single issue with the hope of keeping the Obama agenda together and particularly to keep the gender gap.
You know, though, we should remember that this past session, this spring, Governor McDonnell, Republican, he also did the same thing. He told them to cool it, and he was successful in getting rid of some bills or not making them very prominent. But obviously, you know, the ultrasound bill and some other bills did go through, or, you know, they debated them, about them.
That's true.
Lynn, thank you so very much for your call. We have Bob Roberts from James Madison University, Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute, and Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy, as our panel. And now we are joined by phone, the U.S. congressman who has just been elected to an, I believe it's 11th term in office. He's a Republican representing Virginia's 6th congressional district, which includes much of the Shenandoah Valley. Bob Goodlatte. Congressman, congratulations, and thank you for making time for us.
Well, thank you, and it's good to be with you and your listeners.
Did I get that right? You are about to start an 11th term in office?
Yeah, that's right. I was elected in 1992.
Do you like Washington at this point, sir?
No, it's not a lot of fun right now, but you know what? These are pressing problems that require some hard work, and I believe that the voters of the 6th District wanted to have conservative representation in Washington, and that was reflected in the outcome of the election. So I intend to carry their values to Washington once again.
Well, you've answered part of my first question or main question already, and what I wanted to ask was how you were reading what voters were saying in the election. But I want to ask you if you could widen that to outside of your district, if you see something in all of Virginia's electorate and how the vote went statewide or even nationwide.
Well, obviously, the electorate is very divided, and I was hopeful that we would have a more clear sense of direction, and that that clear sense of direction would be the election of Mitt Romney as president, and Republicans would win control of the Senate. But that was not to be, so we go back to a dynamic that is changed in the sense that now the president's been reelected and does not have to run for election again, but it also is very much the same as it was in terms of a very different view of what it takes to grow our economy and get these huge deficits under control on the part of House members and on the part of the Senate, where they haven't even passed a budget in nearly 4 years.
Congressman, just before we got you on the air, you may have heard this when you were on hold and we were finishing up a conversation with Lynn. Her point is something that we have heard often from callers over the past several months, a sense that Republicans have overreached on a social agenda, especially in Virginia, in the state legislature, which you're not involved with, but I'm sure that you knew about and sort of kept track of what was going on. But even on a national sense, where the anti-abortion, anti-gay rights has turned off some people. Do you have any sense of whether that assessment is at all valid?
Well, again, I think the electorate is very divided on these issues. As you know, from following what goes on in Washington and in Richmond, in Washington, 95% of what we work on in the Congress is related to spending, taxes, and government regulations. And social issues are important to people, but they play a very small role in day-to-day activities of members of Congress and members of the state legislature, for that matter, as well. So there are people on both sides of the ledger who are single-issue voters who focus on a particular concern they have, and I think it's incumbent upon all elected officials to be cognizant of that. But it's also important for us to recognize that everyone has values, and they bring those values to their jobs in Washington. And again, as I said at the outset, I believe that I was elected by a very, very large majority of my constituents because they have conservative values that they want reflected in the Congress.
Congressman, as you may know, we have our usual political panel with us today, Bob Roberts, Bob Gibson, Anita Kumar, all folks that I believe you know personally, and I think each of them probably have a question for you. Bob Roberts.
Congressman, this is Bob Roberts. How would you solve the fiscal cliff issue? In other words, compromise has to be made. What compromise do you think the president should make, and what compromises do you think Republicans should make?
Well, I think, first of all, everything has to be on the table, including tax reform. I do not agree with the president in his request that the wealthy pay more. He also says the wealthy pay their fair share, but as a matter of fact, the top 1% of American families pay 38% of all personal income tax in the country. And as you know, we have the highest corporate income tax rate in the world. So I think it's a fool's errand to think that raising rates is going to get us out of the malaise that we are in terms of the lack of economic growth, or solve our out-of-control government spending problem, because historically, more tax revenues have meant that elected officials have spent more money, not used it to bring spending in check, and that's why we haven't balanced the budget at all.
Congressman, if I could interrupt for just a second, I'm just curious if you have more of an answer specific to Dr. Roberts' question about whether there's something you think the president should be willing to compromise and if there's something that you think Republicans should be willing to compromise.
Well, I was in the process of answering that by saying that I don't think it is in the form of tax increases, but I do think it is in the form of tax reform. There is a lot that can be done to eliminate deductions and credits, what some people consider to be loopholes, but someone else obviously considers to be beneficial to their tax planning. And I think all of it amounts to a very inefficient way to collect revenues and a way that is very complex. It discourages investment, and it is, I think, harmful to our economy. So tax reform should be on the table, and every portion of government spending has to be on the table. Domestic discretionary spending, that's been the subject of substantial cuts already. Defense spending, which has been the focus of substantial cuts already. And then entitlement programs, two-thirds of the federal budget that has been largely untouched to this point, and yet that's the portion of federal government spending that is growing out of control. Program like Medicare.
Again, I apologize for interrupting, but we're running short on the amount of time that we are allowed to be with you before you have to go on to your next event. And I want to ask Anita or Bob Gibson. We probably only have time for one question, gang, but either one of you have a question for Bob Goodlatte. This is Anita Kumar.
Yeah, Congressman, how are you? You heard the president talk on Friday, also on the fiscal cliff, and he mentioned that you had mentioned that the country's very divided, which we saw last Tuesday. President Obama mentioned, well, people have put him back into office, that the majority of Americans agree with him that taxes should be raised on the wealthy, and he feels that it is a mandate. And I wondered what you thought when you heard that.
Well, I thought that he wasn't listening to my constituents, because they certainly have not been telling me that. And I also wonder whether he's using his best judgment in how to lead the country forward in this situation. There is definitely a willingness on the part of Republicans to examine lots of things that have historically been very much favored, sometimes by Republicans, sometimes Democrats, in our tax code. And to have a real overhaul of that tax code, I believe, and many economists believe, could have a very, very positive impact on raising revenues by growing the economy as opposed to raising revenues by simply taxing more in the poor economy that we're in now.
Bob Gibson, quick question.
Quick question, Congressman. Many, many thousands of voters in Ohio and in Florida had to wait 5 hours or more in line to vote. The president said on election night, we've got to fix that. Do you see a federal role in fixing that?
Well, I think it's primarily one of states and localities addressing this. I traveled around my district, visited many, many polling places. Some of the places with the highest turnout had no lines. Why? Because they had a more efficient process of processing the voters, usually in the form of more voting machines available to them relative to the number of people at the precinct. What I found was that the precinct that had the longest wait that I found in my district, and I think there may have been some even longer that I didn't visit, two hours wait for some people. They had only four machines in a voting district that had over 3,500 voters with a high turnout.
But Congressman, you see this as a state issue?
Well, this is something where you have to be able to handle the proper allocation of voting machines to precincts, so that those that have these heavy turnouts and don't have enough voting machines need to have more. That's not something that has to be solved in Washington, D.C. That needs to be solved in the local registrar's office.
Congressman Bob Goodlatte, Republican, who's been representing Virginia in Washington since January of 1993. His 6th district stretches from just south of Roanoke northward through much of the Shenandoah Valley. Congressman, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, folks.
We have three politics watchers with us today on Virginia Insight, speaking to us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, the man who heads up the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson. Would you stop having such a good time over there, Bob Roberts? I haven't even said your name yet. She's going to fall off your chair laughing. And it wasn't anything about Congressman Goodlatte, by the way. It was another completely different story that just Bob is entertaining us. Speaking with us by phone, White House correspondent for the McClatchy Newspaper Group, Anita Kumar. And here with me in our Insight studio in Harrisonburg, the man who always cheers up these discussions, James Madison University political science professor Bob Roberts. I'm Tom Graham. Next call is coming in from Broadway. Troy, thanks for hanging on. Your question or comment, please.
Yes. No, I was just going to comment. You know, I'm a conservative guy, you know, and I go out and vote every year. My family goes out and votes. We went down there. There just weren't a lot of conservatives out there. And I was talking to my father-in-law. I really think this year, this voting session, it was pretty much the Republicans' fault that they lost it. But I felt like more just on the case of laziness from the Republicans that just didn't get out and vote, even the swing voters that, you know, would vote Romney anyway. What I would like to see, I think, coming up in the next 4 years is really coming from Obama, more of a reasonable working with the conservative party with that. I still think it's over half America that feels the conservative way, that he'd be a little bit more, you know, compassionate to that side of America.
Troy, let me ask you about something that you just said. I hark back to the beginning of the Tea Party movement a few years ago, mm-hmm. when Tea Partiers said, what we want is fiscal conservatism. That's what our movement is going to be all about. Mm-hmm. But it didn't take all that long before social conservatism moved in as well.
Right.
And when somebody says the conservative way these days, I'm not sure
right.
if they're talking about social issues like abortion and gay rights, or if they're talking about what some people see as the original conservative issues of smaller government and spending
right.
less money, taxing less.
Right. And I think, honestly, I think from everybody that a big predominant part of it is, you know, you've got a lot of obviously Christian conservative voters, and I don't care what color they are, what they look like. There's a ton of them out there. So they're obviously going to be concerned with the obviously the religious morality of issues that are hot button issues. And then, you know, I think they're going to have to tap back into the also just the fiscal conservatism. And again, I think it's just education.
So, Troy, when you talk about wanting President Obama to be more sensitive to, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, the conservative way, mm-hmm. are you talking about being more sensitive to people who are against abortion being legal or people who want to minimize the expansion of gay rights, or are you talking simply about fiscal conservatism?
For me, it's everything.
Okay.
But I'm a think-outside-of-the-box guy. I would like to see talk on one specific area just regarding our country and the way that we spend. Just take that alone. We don't like his ideas. And it's not, I think that the viewpoint is obviously trying to be minimized, I feel, in the social media networks. There's over half of Americans don't like that way of spending. We don't want to be in debt to China. It's kind of a joke. You go Saturday Night Live, whatever show, you know, like China owns us.
Okay, Troy, hang on just a second, because one of our guests, mm-hmm. Bob Gibson, the leader of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, mm-hmm. His institute's whole function involves getting people of different political perspectives talking to each other and listening to each other. Bob Gibson, I'm curious about what strikes you as you listen to Troy's comments.
Well, it's a good call, and he's making some good points about how divided we are, because there are many, many conservatives in this country who are upset. President Bush kind of hurt the Republican brand, and Governor Romney didn't exactly fix the Republican brand with conservatives to do much better than had been done 4 years ago. Fixing the fiscal cliff will take trust, it'll take compromise, it'll take working across the aisle, and those things have not been in high regard and practiced well in Washington the last 2 years. So it remains to be seen how much trust and how much compromise and how much ability to work across the aisle can be brought into Washington. You know, I think Congressman Goodlatte mentioned that there are ways of handling revenue without handling tax rates, and I think they're going in that direction. So I think there are plenty of opportunities if they'll take them.
Troy, thank you so very much for sharing your thoughts with us. We have a few more minutes to take calls, and now all of a sudden all of our phone lines are open. So if you have a thought on the meaning of the recent election, either nationwide or right here in Virginia, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Bob Roberts, whenever we have you here, we have to talk money and money in Virginia. Mm-hmm. To what degree, if compromise is not reached in Washington by the end of the year on this so-called fiscal cliff, where automatic budget cuts go into effect and taxes automatically go up, will Virginia be hurt any differently than the rest of the country by that?
It's projected that Virginia within a year could lose 210,000 jobs. Now, whether that's true or not remains to be seen. But that's the projection.
Is that just defense jobs or is that
primarily defense jobs, other cuts combined, everything. And so Virginia would be hit very, very hard.
Because Virginia has more federal spending than most other states?
We get about $20,000 per person in Virginia, which is only behind Alaska in terms of per capita federal spending. That's everything. Medicare, Social Security, everything, and defense. But Virginia would be hurt, and the governor has said so. The governor has issued to state agencies, prepare for 4% cuts across the board, in anticipating that there may be a crisis next year.
This is our Republican governor, right. Bob McDonnell, who's going into his last year right. of term. Is he blaming the current economic situation in Virginia, which is taking something of a downturn, on Democrats?
This could be construed as such. The state revenues have been down the last couple of months. They're below projections. How much of that is anticipation of what might come? We don't know. But clearly, the state's economy is doing worse than it was. Our unemployment rate hasn't increased yet, but he's anticipating problems, and that's why he's, like any governor does in this state, they prepare for cuts, and he is not about to propose a tax increase. So unless this fiscal cliff is solved, I suspect the state is going to have to make some rather dramatic cuts by the middle of next year.
Anita Kumar, there in Washington, White House correspondent now. There has been some talk in the political pundit sphere, if I can call it that, that the Democrats might just be willing to go off the fiscal cliff, that if they can't get what they see as a reasonable compromise, that they're willing to let the sequestration cuts go into effect, the new taxes go into effect, because they think that they would lose less that way.
Well, there's one theory out there, and of course the Democratic leadership so far has not said that they would be willing to do this, but there's one theory out there. If at the end of the year, December 31st, all of these tax cuts that have been around for, you know, basically a decade, they're George W. Bush tax cuts is what we call them, they would expire. And the Democrats really want to increase, as we've heard throughout the program, taxes on the wealthy. If they let those expire, the wealthy will be taxed more. Of course, so will everybody else. So there's one theory that, you know, the Democrats could get what they wanted if they let those expire, and then the Republicans would have to want to work with them next year, because nobody wants everything to expire. Nobody wants all these spending cuts. So the theory there is, well, we could let them all expire, and then we could take another look in January. There's a big incentive to try to work together after something's already gone into effect. I don't know that they're going to do that right now. It's just the beginning, so they're talking about compromising, although they're not being very specific about what that might be.
But if you do that, the stock market would take a huge plunge.
Right, and Democrats, and I think Democrats and Republicans would get blamed for that. I think, you know, Congress has one of the lowest, if not the lowest, approval ratings right now. It's 11%. This Congress that's finishing up last month has passed less bills than any other Congress in 60 years. I mean, I do think that that would get blamed on both Democrats, Republicans, President, Congress, everybody.
Anita, let me follow up with something I just heard from Bob Roberts. Bob Roberts, if you see that this is going to be a major problem for Wall Street, and I guess you're talking about many people who are in the 1%, if the Democrats allowed, because they couldn't get from the Republicans what they wanted, the fiscal cliff to become a reality, is it your scenario that the Republican, the high-end wealthy Republicans who help fund the party would give the most pushback to tell their party, you've got to compromise?
I think that could happen, but the problem is that if the market takes a huge plunge, it's going to hurt everybody. And therefore, you may get that scenario in 3 or 4 months working. But the loss of confidence in the stock market, financial markets, probably isn't worth the risk. And I think that's why they're probably going to reach an agreement to do something. What Bob Goodlatte said, I was somewhat surprised that he was so open to the idea of tax reform, which could raise a lot of revenue. And that's probably what they're going to go with. Now, whether Obama will agree to that is an interesting question, because would he agree to say, okay, I'll go to tax reform with a fallback provision saying that if you're earning so much, you're still going to have to pay more. In other words, we're not going to require everyone to pay more automatically. But if you don't pay more, there's going to be a kick-in clause that says you have to pay more. So we're not going to require everybody to pay more. So you could get in these really difficult negotiations. I think they're going to come up with something.
Well, let's leave this cheerful topic to check a couple of other things with Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute. All those years that you covered the Virginia General Assembly as a newspaper reporter before you moved to this job, Bob Gibson, any prediction about what's going to be important in the General Assembly this year?
I think uranium will be, because there is going to be a significant effort to remove the state's moratorium on uranium mining, which affects the entire Piedmont of Virginia and the water supply, potentially, all the way down to Virginia Beach and into North Carolina. So I think there will be a major issue there. I think the Speaker has told the Republicans in the House to cool it on some of these social issue bills that have come back year after year and perhaps hurt the Republicans in terms of the way they appeal to women voters in particular. So it's a short session. They will have to deal with the budget problem, and they'll have to deal with uranium.
I do think that they will talk about elections. People standing in line for 4 hours in parts of the state on election day, there's going to be some people proposing some changes to that. I don't think they'll pass, but I think they'll propose some.
Is the fact that 2013 is a gubernatorial election year going to influence how things play out in Richmond?
Heavens, no.
I'm sorry. I was speaking over you, Bob Gibson. Some people may have missed that. Please repeat yourself.
Of course not. I mean, an election year, you think they'll put in some brochure bills? They've already enshrined some in the state's constitution. Why stop?
Well, speaking of that, we have this question on Facebook that just came in from Harold, who says, what happened to the constitutional amendments that were on the ballot? What did they really mean, and who was really behind them? Why don't you take that, Mr. Gibson?
Well, they are brochure bills. At least one of them was. One of them was totally non-controversial. The second, which passed with 80-some percent. The first
and that,
one,
let's explain that just briefly. The second one was to give the General Assembly
seven more days leeway in terms of scheduling their veto override or reconvene session. So there was
so
no
if that session was to fall on a religious holiday, they could wait and hold it later.
Right. If it fell on Passover, they could.
So that was the non-controversial one. Tell us about the controversial one.
Well, the controversial one wasn't all that controversial because it passed by a huge margin, and it will allow the state to put in the Constitution the language that had been put in the state law, saying that you can't take someone's property without fair compensation, and they define that differently. So it basically enhances a person's property rights at the expense of local government attempting to take over property for economic development purposes.
Which is a very bad idea.
But Harold asks who was behind them. What you're saying in calling these brochure bills is
people
that
people running statewide for attorney general generally are the people behind these bills.
So this is primarily Republican conservatives who want to appeal to their base.
They want to appeal to the state's electorate.
Broader.
A huge electorate. So,
the attorney general.
It was a very popular bill.
Attorney general, yeah.
The attorney general, Ken Cuccinello, was very supportive of this and strongly defended it, even testified about it, which doesn't happen that often.
And he can run on it. So it's a good issue to run on if he gets the nomination, that he's protecting people's property rights.
And most people like the idea of their property rights being protected, but what you're saying,
Bob Roberts, is
it goes too far.
If I'm a community trying to attract a large business that creates jobs in my community, and I have to put together a bunch of land, and I've got one or two landowners who refuse to sell,
you're going to have to pay them fair market value.
Well,
You already have to pay them fair market value.
Yeah, local government was not happy with this amendment.
No.
They lobbied against it.
They lobbied heavily against it.
Oh, Anita Kumar, we're almost out of time, but before we go away, let's talk some about your next travel plans.
I'm going to Thailand and Burma on Thursday. Burma now is the country known as Myanmar, so I'm going to have to get used to saying that. So I'm going with the president, is going for to three countries for 3 days. He's going to be in Burma for 3 hours. That's not a joke. So he has a summit, and Burma is a new emerging democracy. So he wants, I think he's going to be the first president there in decades.
There's been some chatter about whether he might go to his ancestral land of Kenya sometime in this term, since he did not go in his first term. Have you heard anything?
I have heard a rumor. We don't know the actual trips for next year, that he will go to Africa, but I don't know where. There's also a summit, I believe, next year in Russia that he might attend.
Our guests have been Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Roberts, Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, and the McClatchy Newspaper's White House correspondent and Charlottesville native, Anita Kumar. Gang, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell, Tony Field, and Andrew Windham at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org. And once you're there, then click on Programs. And then click on Virginia Insight. And if you do all that, you will find links to more information about our guests. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.